From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, Bill Moyers talks about his latest documentary, Rikers, an American Jail and the Nation's Incarceration Crisis. And Grammy Award-winning singer Rhiannon Giddens talks about the inspiration behind her new and powerful new album. It's called Freedom Highway. But first, the fallout from James Comey's firing as head of the FBI and the alleged links between Russia and President Trump's campaign has raised the question, can or should President Trump be impeached? Alan Lichtman is the Distinguished Professor of History at American University in Washington, D.C. He's also author of the new book, The Case for Impeachment. He has predicted every presidential election since 1984, and he predicts President Trump will likely be impeached. He joins us now to tell us why. Professor, good to have you on the program.
Great to be with you.
Before I jump into the book, let me start with a clip. I'm sure you've all seen this by now. President Trump was in Israel standing alongside their PM. Mr. Netanyahu, take a listen to what President Trump had to say.
Just so you understand, I never mentioned the word or the name Israel. Never mentioned it during that conversation. They were all saying I did. So you had to know the story wrong. Never mentioned the word Israel.
Professor, I don't know how you hear that, but it sounds to me, at the very least, that that was an implicit admission that the president was running his mouth about something in the Oval Office with those Russians.
Well, he was running his mouth, apparently, about things he shouldn't have been talking about at all, and that is information so sensitive and so highly classified that the White House pleaded not to release it to the American people. And remember, you're dealing here with the Russians, who have perhaps the most sophisticated intelligence operation in the world, sophisticated enough to meddle fundamentally with the American presidential election. He doesn't have to use the word Israel. The Russians are going to figure it out, and that's one of the very sad things about this undisciplined president.
Use the word undisciplined. Just hear me out before you laugh. I wonder on matters like these, and there are others I could list where President Trump is concerned, whether or not this president is arrogant or ignorant. And by ignorant, I don't mean stupid. I mean ignorant that he just doesn't know where the lines are. He doesn't know that you can't ask Comey for loyalty. He doesn't know that he shouldn't have said this in front of Russians. He doesn't know. Is he arrogant? Is he ignorant? Is he both? You're not buying it? Break it down for me.
I think he's both. In the book, The Case for Impeachment, I go through the extensive history of Donald Trump prior to his presidential campaign. And here is one of the fundamental points that I make in the book about Donald Trump. Donald Trump has never been held accountable for anything. Mm-hmm. He's always been able to slip away, declaring bankruptcy, walking away from deals and leaving others accountable, protracting litigation, settling out litigations. And he still does not understand what it actually means to be accountable for what you say and for what you do. And as I point out in my book, what he still hasn't realized is the ultimate accountability under our constitutional system is impeachment.
Yeah, he hasn't figured that out, but let me stare at this question for just a little bit longer. I wonder whether or not there are examples, again, like these, where Donald Trump was just, because he's not been held accountable, because he is, in fact, arrogant, that he just doesn't know sometimes what he is saying. He doesn't know when he's crossing the line. Do you buy that at all?
Not entirely. I think for Donald Trump, it's very self-serving. I talk in the book about Donald Trump entering into a new era, much like George Orwell's 1984, where truth is just shattered. His aide, Kellyanne Conway, called it alternative facts. Mm-hmm. Of course, there are no such thing as alternative facts. For Donald Trump, all that matters is what he believes at the moment and what he thinks serves him at the moment. Not only has he never been accountable, Donald Trump has no shame. And I'm not sure the media has caught on to this. You can't catch him in anything. You can't shame him. He doesn't care. It doesn't matter to him.
Okay, one more time. I'll ask you another way. Do you believe that when Donald Trump had James Comey come to the Oval Office, that he fully knew that saying what he's alleged to have said to the head of the FBI, asking for his loyalty, here's a guy, to your point, who has never been held accountable for anything. Everybody in his organization is loyal to him only. He is the king of the Trump organization. He's done this, I suspect, many times to thousands of employees. Do you believe that Donald Trump knew when he asked Comey to take a loyalty oath, essentially, that he was wrong to say that to the head of the FBI?
I think he absolutely knew it was wrong, but Donald Trump doesn't care about right or wrong, and that's been his MO throughout his life.
Do you think Donald Trump knew when he was talking out of that side of his mouth in the Oval Office to those Russians, do you think he knew he was violating our secrets?
Absolutely. I do believe. I don't give Donald Trump a pass on ignorance, because what he's doing as president is consistent with what he did for 40 years in private life.
Okay. So now to impeachment and your text specifically. For
right.
those who don't understand how the process works and when, in fact, it is applicable, let's just start with the basics of what impeachment is, when it ought to be a real option, how the process works, and we'll go from there.
Right. This is all laid out in my book. I'll give the brief summary. The framers put impeachment into the Constitution as the ultimate safeguard of our democracy. They didn't look at it as some catastrophic event. They looked at it as a constitutional, peaceful, and orderly way of protecting us from a rogue president, as an alternative from the way you removed rulers of their time, which was assassination or revolution. And they advisedly put it not in the courts. So it's not a strictly legal process. They put it in a political body, the U.S. House of Representatives. So it's a combined legal, political, and moral judgment. As Alexander Hamilton put it, impeachment should occur when there's some fundamental violation by public men of their trust, some basic abuse of power that harms the society itself, and it doesn't require an indictable crime. It simply requires a majority vote of the U.S. House of Representatives. And if a president is impeached, he is then tried by the U.S. Senate, and removal requires a two-thirds vote of the Senate.
Donald Trump may or may not be impeached. What I'm asking now is whether or not, given what you believe, what others believe he has done to date, are those offenses impeachable?
I think there are certainly impeachable offenses on the table against Donald Trump, more than significant enough to begin an impeachment investigation in the proper venue, which is the House Judiciary Committee. You know, the Republicans were very hot to impeach Bill Clinton on obstruction of justice.
Mm-hmm.
What was Bill Clinton obstructing? A private consensual affair. There is now a pretty substantial pile of evidence indicating that Donald Trump is investigating something of orders of magnitude more significant, that is possible collusion with an attack on the United States. Not a military attack, but an attack on our democracy and the integrity of our elections. That alone should start an impeachment investigation, much less all the allegations about collusion with Russians. And by the way, another area, of course, is his conflicts of interest, his violation of the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution, which says, without explicit authorization from Congress, if you're president, you can't take anything of value from a foreign nation. There's already evidence that he is taking things of value from foreign nations. That's worthy of investigation as well.
If I hear you correctly, what you're suggesting or saying is that Bill Clinton's activities are child's play compared to what Donald Trump is now accused of.
That's right. And even Watergate, which was, you know, of tremendous significance for the country, I would say is not as important as the kinds of things that are swirling around Donald Trump, because in the Trump case, they involve a foreign power, they involve the future of our democracy, and they involve the national security of the United States. And by the way, we can talk about this, even though we now have a special counsel, that's not enough.
Let's talk about it now. Why is a special counsel not enough? And while you're at it, do you like the fact that Robert Mueller has been chosen to be that special counsel?
I like Robert Mueller just fine. I think he's a very important choice. But a special counsel is not an impeachment investigator. As I said, impeachment can involve abuses of power or violations of the Constitution that are not explicit crimes. A special counsel looks only into explicit crimes. A special counsel works in secret. Unless he charges people or ultimately decides to issue a report, we may never know what he has uncovered. Special counsels take years to do their work. That's why, as in Watergate, we need both a special counsel and an impeachment investigation by the House Judiciary Committee, the proper constitutional venue that would look into impeachable offenses and that would both investigate and, as in Watergate, have a public role of holding hearings open to all of us so that we can understand what's happening here, and that would complete its work in something short of the years that typically special prosecutors or special counsels take. If we had waited in Watergate for the special prosecutors to complete their work and not started that House Judiciary Committee investigation, the nightmare of Watergate might have gone on much, much longer to the detriment of America.
You and I both know the Republicans have shown no evidence whatsoever that they are willing to take the advice you've just offered about the next step that they indeed ought to take. What does that say then to you, at least, about the Republicans who are running the House?
Well, I think it's a very sad commentary. I'm not talking about articles of impeachment. I'm talking about an impeachment investigation in the venue where the Constitution puts it. But let me say a couple of things about that. First of all, one of the Lichtman rules of politics is that the first requisite of an office holder is survival. Every Republican in the U.S. House will be up for re-election in 2018. If they think that Trump has become a real liability to their re-election and a liability to getting their agenda through, they may be willing to jettison this president. It would only take some 10% of Republicans in the House, about two dozen, to join with Democrats to get a House majority. About that many sit in seats won by Hillary Clinton in 2016, and many more sit in vulnerable seats. I would call upon every Republican and every Democrat in the Congress to do what the Congress did during Watergate, and that is put patriotism above party. The Congress voted the House almost unanimously to begin an impeachment investigation in the House Judiciary Committee. They voted 33-3 to subpoena the White House tapes. When it came time for voting on articles of impeachment in the House Judiciary Committee, more than a third of Republicans joined Democrats to vote for at least one article. I would also call on Donald Trump to welcome an impeachment investigation in the House Judiciary Committee. If what he says is true, and he's done nothing wrong as candidate or president, this would be his ultimate opportunity to dispel those dark clouds that hang over his administration. He should encourage every member of his campaign team and relevant members of the administration to testify. And unlike Michael Flynn, he should turn over all relevant documents and any presidential tapes, if in fact they exist in this case.
I don't need to tell you this because you live in Washington, but that notion of bipartisanship went out the door when those persons left Congress. I mean, I don't know a single Republican, I don't mean to cast aspersion on them as a group, but I don't see a Howard Baker in the United States Senate right now who'd have the nerve, the chutzpah to ask, what did the president know and when did he know it? Do you see that Republican in the Senate right now?
Well, of course, it would have to start in the House.
Of course. I'm just making the point. I don't see those kinds of persons in the House or the Senate these days.
I don't either, to tell you the truth, but I am a firm believer in the fundamental rule of political survival in the House. And if, in fact, the politics turned toxic for Republicans under the Trump administration, you might get enough. A couple of things to look for. The special election that's coming right up in Montana, you know, deep red Montana, that Trump won overwhelmingly. Imagine if a Democrat wins there. And then next month, of course, we have the special election runoff in Georgia. That'd be another one to watch to see the effect of the Trump factor on House Republicans. I do see some more patriotic voices in the Senate, though, and maybe they'll have some moral suasion. John McCain, Lindsey Graham have certainly been more forthcoming than House members to talk about the problems confronting this administration. Look, we are talking about the national security of the United States. We are talking about the president's national security advisor, the man privy to all the secrets, who not only has said he's going to plead the fifth, but has refused to follow through and give the Congress documents. You can't plead the fifth, as far as I know, I'm not a lawyer, on documents. And by the way, one of the charges One of the articles of impeachment voted on by the Judiciary Committee against President Nixon was his defiance of congressional subpoenas. The Trump administration and its former national security advisor are treading into perhaps some very deep quicksand here, because Trump and his administration have not been very forthcoming about turning over documents either.
I'm trying to keep an open mind here, but just to push back just a little bit, you know, on that notion that you are starting to see or hear some patriotic voices in the House. These are the same people. I speak now specifically of the House Speaker Paul Ryan. These are people who on the campaign trail repeatedly had the opportunity to push back on Donald Trump, and they played it safe. So you're right. They want to protect their own hide. They want to protect their own seat, but they didn't push back against Trump when they had an opportunity. John McCain was in trouble running. I like John McCain. He was in trouble running in Arizona, and he got a little wishy-washy and tried to have it both ways about his endorsement of Donald Trump. So I hope you're right that if it comes to that they will find the courage and conviction and character to do what's right. But to date, I haven't seen those examples.
I haven't either. But there's a long way to go in this administration. It took 3 years to impeach Andrew Johnson. Bill Clinton was impeached well into his second term. The House Judiciary Committee voted articles of impeachment against Nixon well into his second term. And then, of course, he resigned to avoid certain impeachment and near certain
conviction. You're not telling
Senate.
Me that we can get Trump in his second term, are you?
No, but I'm saying you can't expect these things to move quickly. This is the federal government. This is politics in Washington. And events, quite frankly, so far are moving far more rapidly than they have in previous examples.
We talked earlier about Howard Baker, who, of course, once served in the Senate.
Yes.
Mike Pence, the former governor of my home state of Indiana, once served in the House. He is now the vice president. And I was reading your book, and I was fascinated to learn that vice presidents can also be impeached. And I raise this issue because over the past few weeks, we have seen a lot of information coming out here and there about what Mike Pence knew and when he knew it. And a number of times Mike Pence has spoken publicly and said things we found out later were not true. He had to backtrack on those things. It's one of the reasons why Michael Flynn is no longer in his position right now, because he set the vice president up. But the point is that it's a fascinating conversation to have, not just about the president's impeachment, but the vice president is also on that list.
Right. You have to read the book, The Case for Impeachment, to get all the nuances, obviously, of how impeachment works. We can just touch the surface here. But I do point out in the book that the vice president is subject to impeachment as well. And I just wrote an article indicating that Mike Pence should be investigated as well. Why are we assuming, with all of these lies that Pence have told about General Flynn, about his not knowing that General Flynn had been paid by a foreign government, about his giving false information to the American people about the real reason why Trump fired Mr. Comey? Are we assuming this guy who served for some one dozen years in the Congress, served several years as governor of Indiana, is so naive, is so ignorant that he's constantly being fooled and marching out in front of the American people and not telling the truth? Or, in fact, is there more to it? The only way to know is to include Mike Pence in any investigation of Donald Trump as well. And the case for impeachment shows how that can proceed.
There are many Democrats, as you well know, Professor Lichtman, who are anxious, chomping at the bit, if you will, to get these impeachment hearings started. Maxine Waters, my congresswoman here in L.A., is one of those persons who has not held her tongue about this, and there are others. On the other side, there are Democrats who are saying, tread very cautiously on this, because the country is already divided. It was a very ugly and divisive election in November, and you do not want to be seen as going after Donald Trump just because you don't like the guy. And I can hear Trump saying now, y'all didn't like me then, you don't like me now. This is all about attacking and coming after Donald Trump, and no president has ever been treated so badly.
Well, I have to say, first of all, that I make it very clear in the case for impeachment that we should not be impeaching Donald Trump because we don't like him, we don't like his style, we don't like his policies. Impeachment only proceeds from a severe abuse of power. And by the way, talking about treating presidents badly, who was it that perpetrated the biggest and most protracted and most egregious lie against any president. It was Donald Trump who claimed our first African-American president, Barack Obama, was illegitimate because he was really born in Africa. Trump had not a shred of evidence for that. Mm-hmm. It was just a cynical political calculation. But I would tell the leadership of the Democratic Party, it's time to get some courage. What has your leadership done for the Democratic Party since 2008? It's driven it basically into the ground. Impeachment is a proper constitutional procedure, and if the transgressions appear serious enough, an impeachment investigation is absolutely warranted, and you should not be afraid to proceed properly and constitutionally. The lack of courage of the Democratic leadership has not served the Democrats well over these past 8 years.
I don't argue with you at all about the Democrats lacking courage. I can give that speech, you know, any hour of the day or night. But that is, respectfully, though, a fair different issue than protecting their own political base. And to take your point even a step further, it's a different issue, it seems to me, Professor, than the notion of willy-nilly tearing the country farther apart. That is to say that because, again, the country is so divided, unless you have a clear-cut case, unless you know this guy violated the law, unless you can make that stick, unless, again, he has violated the Constitution, you do not want to be accused of a political witch hunt because you don't like the guy.
Absolutely correct, and that's a fundamental thesis of my book for the case for impeachment. And even now, you know, weeks after the book was published, when so much more has come out about potential obstruction of justice, of violations of the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution, I am not advocating impeachment. And this is a huge confusion on the part of so much of the commentary and on the part of the Democratic leadership. Critics of Donald Trump should not be calling for his impeachment. They should be calling for an impeachment investigation, which is proper under the Constitution to determine, as you say, whether there are serious violations of the law, serious abuses of power, egregious violations of the Constitution. And only then should impeachment proceed. But unless we have an impeachment investigation, we're not going to know because the special counsel, for all the respect I have for him, is not an impeachment investigator. And we may never know what the special prosecutor found because he works in secret. And by the way, who fired the special prosecutor in Watergate? Richard Nixon. He found someone in the Justice Department to fire him. Donald Trump could do the same thing. He could find someone in the Justice Department to fire the special prosecutor. And given his history, that would not come as a great shock.
Let me ask you, as an exit question here, to look into your crystal ball and tell me what it will require for those 20 Republicans or so to step across the aisle to say, you know what, things have gotten to a point now where the guy really does need to be at least investigated.
I think it'll require probably a loss in one of the special elections coming up, and it will require a continuing cratering of Donald Trump's approval rating. And it would take experts who follow these House races, like the Cook Political Report, to flip a lot of these races in 2018 to make them even more vulnerable than they are today.
In these crisis times, it is a book well worth reading. It's called The Case for Impeachment, written by the distinguished professor of history at American University, Alan J. Lichtman. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. The U.S. is facing a crisis of mass incarceration. Over 2.2 million people are in American prisons and jails as we speak. Award-winning broadcaster Bill Moyers investigates the human toll of this crisis in his new documentary, Rikers, an American Jail. He chose Rikers Island in New York because almost 80% of the people detained there have not yet been found guilty or innocent of their charges. Moyers joins us now to talk about the project. Before our conversation, hear now a clip from Rikers, an American Jail.
It's gladiator school for real. If you get there and you don't have a weapon to defend yourself, you have an issue.
Violence rules, predator prey. That never changes. I'm in a situation where I can't run from. But my whole time in the streets, that's all I ever been doing is fighting. So I'm looking like I'm in a place where I always trained for, but just didn't know it.
The sad part is the alternative to violence is more violence. And when somebody realizes that you're willing to be more violent than they are less prone to be violent.
They taught me how to use a level of violence that I could never imagine I was capable of doing.
I am heartened, Bill Moyers, by what I think, what I sense, what I feel is an increase, an uptick in the conversation that we're having in this country about mass incarceration. I think I'm right about that. You're not new to this conversation. So two things. One, am I right about the fact that there are more people talking about this? And then I want to follow up on that with some other stuff.
You are right. More people are talking about it. More people are writing books about the experience. More people are realizing that our mass incarceration is a scandal and a stain on the American character. And there is a conversation going on, particularly at the state level, but not so much at the national level yet. There was one beginning before the election when several Republicans and several Democrats were discussing a bipartisan criminal justice reform program. And then, of course, the election and Donald Trump and Jeff Sessions are lock them up and throw away the key type, you know, revive the drug war, put them away. And that's conflicting, clashing with the sentiment that was developing in the country before the election.
For those of us who know your history, and you're on PBS, of course, so we all know your history and revel in it and celebrate it. But I take you back to your days in the Johnson administration when there were riots that broke out around this country, and you were around when Attica happened. I mean, so you know that this is not, again, a new reality in this country. When did you first begin to wrestle with this yourself?
Well, when the war on crime started, the war on drugs began to produce so many people going to jail. Mm-hmm. And it was just suddenly an increase, five times an increase in just a matter of years in the number of prisoners. But I've done a number of documentaries over the years on incarceration. I did the very first documentary ever on television about women in prison back in the 1970s, and I have paid attention to it. But Rikers Island, which sits between Manhattan and Queens, is very visible as you land at LaGuardia. It's just 2.5 miles from where I live. I paid little attention to Rikers Island until there began to be a culture of brutality that was developing there. And after about 15 years, some brilliant investigative journalism by the New York Times, New Yorker Magazine, The New Yorker, and other publications. But all of them were filtered of necessity because of print through the experience of the journalist, not the experience of the witnesses. So I wanted to do a documentary that would allow the detainees at Rikers to tell their own story in their own voices, in their own words, with no filter between them and the audience. And that's when we dug into, we found about 100 former detainees, got a dozen of them to tell us their stories in full. Then we put it together into the arc of the experience, some entry into exit from Rikers. And you know, Tavis, what's happening at Rikers is happening in so many jails. Here in California, the Los Angeles County Jail just had a culture of brutality itself. Mm-hmm. And when you hear these people tell their stories, you really understand what Tom Stoppard in his famous play Night and Day meant when he said, people do terrible things to each other. It's worse when they do them in the dark. Mm-hmm. So an interest that began 25 years ago results in a film in which they're speaking in their own voice and telling us what it's like to be incarcerated in many of America's jails today.
Most of these, I've seen the documentaries, it's a powerful piece of work, so I'm glad that you and your team put it together, so thank you for that. But most of the witnesses in this documentary are people of color. Not all, but most of them, many of them poor, which doesn't surprise anybody who understands what our prison system is all about in this country. But it does lead me to ask why it is that you think the country cares. I know that it matters, but why should they care?
Well, they should care because this is no way to treat people, even those who have committed crimes. This is cruel and inhumane punishment, what's happening in so many of our jails. Many people care because it's gotten very expensive. I mean, Rikers, it costs $208,000 a year to keep somebody in one bed at Rikers. You can go to Harvard twice on that. Mm-hmm. The other thing is there's a growing understanding that incarceration is the sharp edge of American racism. You know, African Americans are arrested 6 times the rate of whites. Hispanics are arrested twice the rate of whites. 80% of the people in Rikers are people of color. A third of them don't need to be in jail at all because they're not a threat to society. They cannot get the kind of treatment that they deserve. I mean, the brutality in many of our jails, whether California or Indiana or Illinois or where, it's just anti-human. And so we need to, if we want to clear up America's human rights record, if we want to do right by people, we need to revisit incarceration.
What you learn about how this culture of violence, this culture of crime, quite frankly, became so institutionalized in prisons?
Because when you lock people up and lock them away and you hire professional guards to take care of them, I mean, people do terrible things to each other. And out of sight, out of mind, we can't avoid it anymore because the numbers, you know, 2.3 million people in this country are locked up at any given time. Here in the Los Angeles County, it's usually around 17,000 on any given day. At Rikers, it's 7,500 to 9,000. And there are 2.7 million children who have a parent or more, or two parents, in prison. I mean, that's a scandal within a scandal here. So we just can't ignore it anymore.
I've seen some comments of late by New York's Mayor Bill de Blasio about closing down Rikers and going at what's been happening on the inside. How is it that this has been allowed to happen for so long without the authorities either being aware of it or concerned enough about it to do something?
Primarily because the populations of prisons are African American and Hispanic. And they're poor, they're marginalized. We don't think very often of poor people in this country. There's a general tendency not to to take their concerns into consideration politically or humanly. So one thing is the population of our prisons are people who've long been marginalized in this country. Secondly, there are people that many other people like to dispose of, get out of sight and out of mind. And then it's always been a political issue, you know, in this country. America has a 250-year history of punitive policies of punishment against people. So a lot of people are relieved when criminals are sent away, locked up, and the key thrown away. But the other thing, Tavis, is that our jails and prisons have become warehouses for people who are mentally ill. Mm-hmm. Back in 1961, believing he was doing the right thing, President Kennedy ended the mental institutions and wanted the residents of those mental institutions to receive care and treatment elsewhere. Well, we never developed the humane establishments that would help those people. A number of them also addicts and alcoholics. They don't need to be in prison. They need treatment. They need help in overcoming their addiction and their disease, and they don't get it. So we lock them up.
Okay. Let me offer this as the exit question. What do you hope the takeaway is for those of us who see this documentary?
I hope we support the kind of reforms that can make a difference. There are reforms going on here in California. We need to reform bail. You know, many people cannot afford bail when they're arrested, so that's why they're held in holding pens. Rikers penetrated the consciousness of New Yorkers when a 17-year-old was arrested for allegedly stealing a backpack. He was sent to Rikers to be held. He wasn't sent to trial, so he stayed 3 years. He was sent to solitary confinement when he kept protesting, and he was brutalized by the guards. He got out, he got out of solitary confinement, went back to his cell, tried to commit suicide. So for trying to commit suicide, they put him in solitary confinement again. He finally got out at 20. 3 years later, without a trial, he was released, and a year later, he took his life. A marvelous young journalist wrote a profile of that story. His mother could not afford bail. That's why they held him. And he took his life. That story really woke America, woke New Yorkers up. Still, we had not seen the faces and heard the stories of the inmates, detainees at Rikers, which is why we did this documentary. I did research. I could not find one documentary that had allowed inmates, detainees, to tell their story in their own voice. Usually there's a narration, usually there are edited interviews, and there's been a terrific reaction. You mentioned the mayor wanting to close the prison and close Rikers in 10 years. That recommendation came from an independent commission chaired by a former state Supreme Court Justice, and they came to the conclusion that Rikers should be closed, number of inmates released, those who don't need to be there, and then distributed in new jails near the courthouses throughout the city, throughout the four boroughs. The mayor heard about this. He was no strong advocate of doing anything right now, and he got ahead of it and said, well, we can do it. It'll take us 10 years. Mm-hmm. But it's got to be done in less than 10 years.
Yeah. Well, thank you for doing this and for all the other brilliant work you've done over the years. And,
thank you, Tavis.
You'll want to see it on PBS, check your local listings for time of airing.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Rhiannon Giddens is a founding member of the Grammy Award-winning group The Carolina Chocolate Drops. She has a new solo album out. It is her second, and it's called Freedom Highway. The project builds a lyrical bridge from our country's history of slavery to civil rights anthems to the sounds of today. Before we start, let's listen to a recent performance of the title track, Freedom Highway, at Sing Sing Correctional Facility.
March down Freedom Highway. Oh, yeah.
I remember reading about this in the New York Times when you actually did this. Why Sing Sing? And tell me what the experience was like.
I mean, it was intense. Yeah. It was a experience of a lifetime, really. I had been to Sing Sing to see one of the programs that the Carnegie, you know, Carnegie had done, working with the prisoners, and I saw the result of that, the concert that they had been working on all year, and the prisoners' songs, and they were singing their own songs and working with these musicians from the outside. I was really profoundly affected by a couple of things, just by the program, which was amazing, but I was also affected, of course, by the color of the people in that prison I walked in, and something that you know here, but to feel it here and to see the result of, you know, our prison system and, you know, centuries of institutionalized.
And by color, you mean
color, yeah.
Melanin.
Yes.
Yeah.
A sea, of that, and just, you know, the result of centuries of institutionalized discrimination, and just see that, you know, and it struck me and became a song, you know, became part of a song that's on this record, and you know, and then the intention to come back in some way, and when it was offered to say, you know, come back, you can't be a part of this project because I was no longer living in New York, but to bring my own show. And I was just like, yes, you know, to bring what we are trying to say, the message that is in this record, the message that has been in my music the whole time, to bring that to the inside and to have the experience with those guys. We had a workshop with them that day. We did one of their songs. I mean, it was just really a profound day.
It is arresting to hear, I mean, all your work is good work, but it's arresting, Rhiannon, to hear this project, the lyrical content, particularly when one considers that so much of your writing here was taking from slave narratives and turning it into song. Tell me about that process.
It was really intense. You know, I was, you know, part of the Carolina Chocolate Drops, and I'd always been into the history, and doing this historical music and playing instruments like this. This is a replica of a banjo from 1858. So I'm like, what was 1858? What was 1855? What was this time like for us? And so going back and reading about the Civil War, reading about, you know, the circumstances, and reading about the atmosphere, and then just reading the stories was really profoundly affecting to me. And what I wanted was a way to tell those stories, but I'm a musician, and they wanted to become songs. I didn't have a choice, really. Like, I started playing this banjo, and then it was just like the first one came out. I read this story in this book, and I was like, and it was just like, it became a song. And I found kind of my mission. You know, it's always been around these sorts of things, but my particular why I'm here, you know, what I do that no one else is doing, and the way that I'm doing it, is connecting the past to these stories, but bringing them into the now, you know, in a way that is different, you know. And so if it sparks somebody to go read a book or to, you know more, or if it just sparks them to think about what's happening today, you know, there's millions of people being held in slavery today. You know, if it's a way to connect, it's like an emotional shortcut. You know, you can read a book, you know, and kind of feel it up here, but a song can go straight to the heart of the matter. And the best way to do that is to pick one story and to get in that person's mind and to have empathy for that person. And then, it spreads to the whole thing.
I haven't had a chance to catch you on tour yet for this project, but I am curious to know, so hopefully I'll see you. But I've been curious to know what the audience response is, given the material on this project. How's the audience take this in? What's a show like when you're doing this stuff?
Well, it's really interesting because we've done Europe and Australia,
yeah,
and now we're just starting here.
So you don't know yet.
You know,
stateside,
and,
yeah.
You know, it is really interesting. You know, so we did Stage Coast Festival, which was great. It's a country music festival, and I'm not holding anything back. We're just doing what we do, and I think people, it's heavy stuff, you know?
It is. That's why I'm asking.
I put it in the context of a show,
right.
So it's not all like slave songs. Like, you know, it has to be these moments of really intense emotion, and then you go to a dance song, then you go to, because it's like the African-American experience isn't just slavery. Mm-hmm. The African-American experience is all this myriad, you know, array of highs and lows, just like anybody else. And so, you know, presenting it in the context of that, I think makes it more powerful, because it's, you know, you get to that song, you're like, whoa, and then, okay, we're doing some other parts, and then we get back to this, you know, really intense stuff, and I think that seems to serve it well, you know. It's just, you just try to reach people in the best way that you can. Now, like, my issue is mostly that I haven't been able to reach much of the black community. Mm-hmm. You know, the black press has completely ignored, the Chocolate Drops has ignored most of what I've done, and you know, trying to put us at our rightful place in the genesis of American music with the black string band music. I mean, there's so much work that needs to be done there. And that's been my frustration, is the makeup of the audiences has been mostly in it. And I love, everybody comes to the show, I love. But, you know, now I'm like, okay, it's at the heart of American music, and we did this, you know what I mean? And so it's frustrating to me, because I'm on an educational mission too, because like I'm like, y'all, really, we're gonna understand a lot more about why things are happening now if we look into minstrelsy. Mm-hmm. We dig into minstrelsy. Mm-hmm. We get in there, bring our allies in, and go, how can we make something of this? How can we understand why 60, you know, years it was the most popular form of American entertainment is minstrelsy? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Why is that at the heart of like every American genre that comes after it? It's in every American entertainment. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, and this is a reflection of cultural, of what's happening in the culture, you know? And so what's now happening in the culture, you can understand all of it the more you dig in what's happening in the past. And we need to do more of that. And it is happening in our culture. Like, it is happening, but like, I'm out there doing the work, you know, like, write an article. Like, you know what I mean? Like this is a beautiful thing, and we need to embrace the beauty of this time too. Yeah, sorry, I'm passionate about it.
No, I ain't mad at you for it. I ain't mad at you. It is a beautiful thing, and you are beautiful. What you're doing is beautiful. Her project, her latest project, is called Freedom Highway. Her name, of course, Rhiannon Giddens. Catch her on tour this summer, but now she's going to grace us with a little bit of play-out music here from the project. Good to have you back. Have a great summer.
Me.
Love seeing you on Nashville, by the way.
Thank you.
Yeah, so you're doing it. You're doing everything now.
I brought this on there,
I
too.
See.
I'll say yes if you let me bring this.
You spreading the word on TV and everywhere else you can.
Doing my best.
Here comes Rhiannon.
Julie, oh Julie, won't you run? 'Cause I see down yonder the soldiers come. Julie, oh Julie, can't you see? Them devils have come to take you far from me. Mistress, oh mistress, I won't run, 'cause I see down yonder the soldiers have come. Mistress, oh mistress, I do see, and I'll stay right here till they come for me. Who love you and all you hold dear. Mistress, oh mistress, I will go. Leave this house and all I know. Mistress, oh mistress, I will leave here. With what family I got left, they're all I hold dear. If they find that trunk of gold by my side, Julie, oh Julie, you tell them in that that trunk of gold is yours, my friend. Mistress, oh mistress, I won't lie. If they find that trunk of gold by your side, mistress, oh mistress, that trunk of gold is what you got when my children you sold. Mistress, oh mistress, don't you cry. The price of staying here is too high. Mistress, oh mistress, I wish you well. But in leaving here, I'm leaving
You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Christabel Nsi Abuadi is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.